Either for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the January 5th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: Wall Street is betting that falling interest rates and strong corporate earnings will be enough to eke out one more year of stock market gains. Though it is likely to be a near-run thing in part because of a cloudier economic picture. Philadelphia Fed President Anna Paulson said the central bank may be able to cut interest rates further if inflation cools, but suggested that any additional reductions might not be coming right away. Private equity's long-awaited consolidation is unlikely to arrive this year, many people who work in the industry say, with the structural challenge of combining buyout shops among the hindrances. Avatar: Fire and Ash and Zootopia 2 retained their positions as leader and runner-up at the weekend domestic film box office, though their dollar receipts declined from a week earlier. Sam Altman's desire to furnish OpenAI with an app store to rival Apple's is running up against the capability of traditional apps, which can't be replaced quickly. Vera Bradley, the maker of quilted bags and accessories, is changing strategy again, following a rebrand that left some of its loyal consumers fuming. The maker of Biscoff cookies is aggressively pursuing production and distribution growth, continuing to exploit its early success in branding a generic product. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. Trump said after the capture and arrest of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro that the U.S. would run the country indefinitely until a safe, proper, and judicious transition could be arranged, and didn't raise the prospect of elections there. Trump's threat to intervene in Iran's protest carries new urgency for Tehran, now that the toppling of Maduro has raised uncertainty about how far the president is willing to go. The first trial in the Mississippi welfare scandal is set to begin this week, nearly 6 years after it erupted in one of America's poorest states. North Korea launched ballistic missiles toward its eastern waters, the country's neighbors said, hours before South Korea's president left for China for talks expected to cover Pyongyang's nuclear program. Heavy rain and high tides, believed to be the most severe in two decades, caused flooding in parts of Northern California, prompting road closures and rescues of people trapped in cars. A private helicopter crashed in Arizona near Telegraph Canyon, about 64 miles east of Phoenix, killing all four people aboard, officials said. A boat capsized in northern Nigeria's Yobe state, leaving at least 25 people dead, while 14 others remained missing, emergency services said. The picture on today's front page shows a large contingent of armed men on motorcycles, and a man is standing among them holding a large picture of Maduro. And that caption reads, "Armed men on motorcycles, supporters of Nicolas Maduro, drove through Caracas a day after Maduro's capture by the U.S. The article, U.S. Raid Leaves Venezuela in Confusion. After Maduro ouster, Trump keeps regime in place while issuing threats to successor. By David Ludlow and Jose de Cordoba. President Trump ticked off a list of reasons for his decision to capture and arrest Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. He talked about the Maduro regime sending illicit drugs and gangs to the U.S. and nationalizing American oil company assets. One thing that wasn't mentioned, a desire to restore democracy in Venezuela. Instead, Trump said after Saturday's raid, the U.S. would run the country indefinitely until a safe, proper, and judicious transition could be arranged. He didn't raise the prospect of elections. The president said it would be tough for the country's opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, who won the Nobel Peace Prize last year, to play a major role, saying she lacked popularity. Instead, he expressed a willingness to work with Delcy Rodriguez, Maduro's vice president, a hardline socialist and regime stalwart. On Sunday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio played down expectations of a quick return to democracy, saying it was unrealistic. They've had the system of Chavismo in place for 15 or 16 years, and everyone's asking why 24 hours after Nicolas Maduro was arrested, there isn't an election scheduled for tomorrow? That's absurd, he said on CBS. Rubio outlined the more immediate goals for the U.S. in dealing with the Venezuelan regime under Rodriguez, who is now the interim president, and said Washington would use a blockade on Venezuelan oil exports and the threat of further military force as leverage to force the government to change its behavior. We want drug trafficking to stop. We want no more gang members to come our way. We don't want to see the Iranian and, by the way, Cuban presence in the past. We want the oil industry in that country not to go to the benefit of pirates and adversaries of the United States, but for the benefit of the people, he said. For many Venezuelans, including millions of those who have fled the country to places like the U.S., the initial glee at hearing of Maduro's capture has given way to growing angst that while Maduro is gone, the rest of his regime remains intact and appears to set to stay in power for the foreseeable future. Venezuelans are alternating between euphoria that Maduro is out, but disappointment that the guys with guns and the structures of guns and corruption is still running the show, said Moises Naim, a former Venezuelan trade minister and analyst at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Even if the regime softens and changes policies to please the Trump administration, that feels more like colonial submission and doesn't give ordinary Venezuelans a say in their future, said Rafael Banega, a community activist in Caracas. This isn't what we expected in any way, and it seems to frustrate our expectations. I can't see most people supporting this, he said. Larry Gumbiner, a former U.S. diplomat who served in half a dozen Latin American countries during a 31-year career, said the Trump administration is giving priority to stability over democracy. Trump's plan, Gumbiner said, appears to be to keep the Maduro government in power minus Maduro, with the condition that the new president carries out Trump's program of allowing U.S. oil companies to rebuild the oil sector, stopping drug trafficking, and stopping support for Colombian guerrillas. If not, the presence of the U.S. fleet keeps alive the threat of a second round of attacks and captures. Maduro to stand trial in U.S. court. Prosecutors must prove the strongman is the boss of a drug cartel. By Jose de Cordoba, Santiago Perez, and Sadie Gurman, Mexico City. Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro had long seemed untouchable, despite a $50 million bounty on his head and a U.S. indictment unsealed in 2020, accusing him of narco-terrorism. Now Maduro, who was whisked out of the country along with his wife after a military strike early Saturday, faces the prospect of a trial in a New York federal court for drug trafficking and conspiring with terrorists. He could appear in court as soon as Monday. They will soon face the full wrath of American justice on American soil in American courts, Attorney General Pam Bondi said on Saturday, referring to Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores. U.S. prosecutors accuse Maduro of being the head of the Cartel of the Suns, a loose-knit organization of senior generals and officials who, over more than two decades, allegedly took millions of dollars in bribes from Colombian guerrilla leaders. The guerrillas financed their war against the Colombian government by shipping thousands of tons of cocaine through Venezuela to the U.S. and Europe, prosecutors say. The group's name refers to the Golden Suns worn by Venezuelan generals on the epaulets of their uniforms. The superseding indictment unsealed Saturday builds on the 2020 charges alleging Maduro ran a cocaine trafficking enterprise that enriched and entrenched Venezuela's political and military elite. The four-count indictment names six defendants, including Maduro's wife, his son, and other senior government officials, charging them with drug and gun offenses. It accuses them of engaging in a narco-terrorism conspiracy by working with drug traffickers that the U.S. considers foreign terrorist organizations, such as the Sinaloa cartel and the Tren de Aragua, the Venezuelan gang. Prosecutors said the massive-scale drug trafficking concentrated power and wealth in the hands of Maduro and his family. The U.S. government says Venezuela has long played an important role in allowing narcotics from Colombia to move through its territory and then onto ships and planes headed to the U.S., the Caribbean, and Europe. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Energy Companies to Face a Challenge Mining Nation's Oil by Colin Eaton, Kegel Vias, and David Uberti. For months, the U.S. sold its pressure campaign against Venezuela as a way to curtail drug trafficking. Now, it's about getting American energy companies access to one of the world's largest oil bounties. The Trump administration's move to oust Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro in a surprise military operation early Saturday will pave the way for U.S. oil companies to regain a foothold in the South American nation, President Trump said at a Mar-a-Lago press conference. But getting foreign companies to flock back to Venezuela will be a massive challenge. Chevron is the only major U.S. oil company there and is the nation's largest foreign investor. Other oil executives will be forced to gauge the stability on the ground in a country where the industry has fallen into disarray after more than two decades of mismanagement and corruption. Chevron and other U.S. oil and gas companies didn't get advance notice of the U.S. incursion or the Trump administration's border Venezuelan strategy, according to people familiar with the matter. The other obstacle facing Trump's effort to put more of Venezuela's viscous crude into the global market is that the world doesn't have much of an appetite for more oil. U.S. oil prices are languishing below $60 a barrel, a level that discourages investment for most American producers. Global supplies are expected to continue rising this year. One thing that works against it is the price of oil, said Ali Mashiri, the former head of Chevron's operations in Latin America and Africa. In the environment we're in, if you're going to invest, do you put it in the Permian Basin in the U.S., or do you put it in Venezuela? That's going to be a tough choice. The U.S. hasn't detailed the mechanics of how it would bring more American oil companies into Venezuela to boost production. Analysts say it could facilitate a process that would allow companies to bid for oil and gas blocks and question whether European companies could also bid for the right to enter the country. Oil companies always want oil, and Venezuela has a lot of it, said Jose Ignacio Hernandez, a law professor, consultant, and public debt expert at Aurora Macro Strategies. But they need political stability, which requires more than just removing Maduro. The situation is still ongoing. Foreign Conflict Intrudes on Political Landscape by Sabrina Siddiqui and Paul Kiernan. Dylan Mockley voted for President Trump in 2024 in hopes of ending wars, reining in government spending, and bringing down inflation. Upon hearing the president say the U.S. would run Venezuela after American forces captured President Nicolas Maduro, the 38-year-old sarcastically said, "Charming, just what I voted for." Instead of spending more money overseas, Mockley said he would prefer to see Trump focused on prices in the U.S. He said the pandemic lockdowns and subsequent inflation surge wreaked havoc on his finances. "I make the most money I ever made in my life and I feel the brokest I've ever been," said Mockley, who owns a food truck business in rural Idaho and routinely sees customers' credit cards declined. He characterized Trump's first year in office as a gigantic disappointment to a monumental degree. He expects to either vote Libertarian or to abstain from voting in the midterm elections. Trump's Venezuela incursion has injected a volatile foreign conflict into a political environment defined by voter anxiety over high prices and a softening job market. Whether Trump can juggle a high-stakes intervention abroad while persuading voters that he is making progress on the economy is poised to determine the political outcome in November, according to interviews with over a dozen strategists, pollsters, and voters. If things go poorly, this will be huge. If things go well, and we're not there that long, it's a plus, said Wes Anderson, a Republican pollster and partner at On Message of the Venezuela incursion. But I cannot imagine that it overcomes the principal driver of this election, which is how average Americans feel about the economy. The White House has said the removal of Maduro is an example of decisive leadership abroad. Before the military operation, polls had consistently shown that a majority of Americans were opposed to military action in Venezuela and that inflation and affordability rank at the top of voters' concerns, surpassing foreign policy. ICE agents tap facial recognition technology on phones, by Michelle Hackman, Arian Campo Flores, and Hannah Critchfield. Until recently, arresting an immigrant suspected of being in the country illegally took time. Immigration agents needed to run the suspect's various forms of ID through different systems, and if the results were inconclusive, book the person into custody for further investigation. But during President Trump's second term, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers have been handed a powerful new tool to speed up arrest: mobile facial recognition technology. Officers can simply point their phones at a suspect's face, snap a picture, and turn up the person's identity and often their immigration status. The app called Mobile Fortify has, in the past few months, become a routine feature of ICE arrest, according to current and former government officials. Agency officials say the technology has made arrest both faster and more accurate, leading to fewer occasions when officers must detain someone, only to learn hours later that they have legal status or are even a U.S. citizen. Wall Street expects rally to keep going, by Crystal Herr. Wall Street is betting that falling interest rates and strong corporate earnings will be enough to eke out yet one more year of stock market gains. It is going to be close. After posting double-digit percentage increases for three straight years from 2023 through 2025, the S&P 500 and other major U.S. indexes enter year four of their rally with stretched valuations on many big stocks and a cloudier economic picture. There are enough positives to give investors and analysts hope, but some worry there isn't enough to to keep up the pace of 2025. We probably have an okay market, but certainly not what we've seen in the last couple of years, said Mark Hackett, Chief Market Strategist at Nationwide. The S&P 500 surged 16% last year with a resilient economy, renewed interest rate cuts, and artificial intelligence fervor propelling the benchmark index to 39 records. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 13%, while the NASDAQ Composite jumped 20%. Wall Street analysts and strategists have predicted the party will continue in 2026. Bank of America expects the S&P 500 to reach 7,100 by the end of this year, a 3.7% gain from the 2025 closing level. J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs expect the benchmark index to reach 7,500 and 7,600, respectively. Their bullishness, in light of the past gains, is reason enough to be cautious, some investors said. The S&P 500 surged roughly 80% from the start of 2023 through New Year's Eve, a torrid pace that will be hard to maintain under most circumstances, they said. Iran faces fresh urgency after Maduro raid, by Benoit Falcon. President Trump's threat to intervene in Iran's protests carries new urgency for Tehran now that the U.S. capture of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro has raised uncertainty around how far the president is willing to go. Trump said Friday that Washington was locked and loaded to come to the aid of Iranian protesters if Tehran cracks down harshly on them. A day later, the U.S. military launched strikes on the capital of Venezuela, an Iran ally, and brought Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, to the U.S. to face criminal charges. It confirms that Trump is unpredictable and truly everything is on the table vis-a-vis Iran, said Sanam Vakil, director of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, a think tank in London. In recent months, the Trump administration has carried out airstrikes on militants in Yemen, Nigeria, and Syria, saying they threatened U.S. or allied interest. But the capture of Maduro, a serving head of state, in a raid on the Capitol, has been the administration's most audacious operation to date. Iran's foreign ministry on Saturday called on the United Nations to step in to stop what it called the illegal U.S. aggression against Venezuela. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, called the capture a clear example of state terrorism in a call with his Venezuelan counterpart, Yovan Gil. A number of top Iranian leaders have threatened to retaliate against the U.S. if Trump carries through with his threat to intervene on the side of the protesters. Iranian leaders were already reassessing their vulnerabilities after a disastrous year in which Israel decisively broke with a long-standing reluctance to attack the country directly and shattered Iran's air defenses in a 12-day war in June. Trump joined the attack late in the war to bomb key Iranian nuclear facilities. Israel also decimated Iranian allies Hezbollah and Hamas, which were key members in Tehran's network of regional militias that helped deter attacks. Maduro's capture will now force the Iranian regime to weigh more heavily the possibility that Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei could be forcibly removed, said Rusbeh Alibabi, an Iranian consultant at geopolitical advisory firm Global Growth Advisors. Maduro's capture is a game changer for Iran, he said. It opens up possibilities that didn't exist in Iran before. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, don't settle for Maduro 2.0. The dictator's cronies are still in power and vowing to resist the U.S. As Sunday dawned in Caracas and Washington, a new reality was also apparent a day after the U.S. snatched dictator Nicolas Maduro in a daring raid. To wit, the dictator's cronies are still running Venezuela, and they don't seem ready to give it up. Is President Trump willing to settle for Maduro 2.0? Delcy Rodriguez, the former vice president, is now the acting president. Like Mr. Maduro, she's been sanctioned by the U.S. and European Union. After Mr. Maduro's capture Saturday, she issued defiant public remarks. She's a hard-line socialist, well known for her close ties to Cuban intelligence. Bis Rodriguez's brother, Jorge Rodriguez, remains in charge of the National Assembly. Also still in power is the notorious Interior Minister, Diosdado Cabello. He declared in Caracas that the U.S. had only partially succeeded in its mission and that the Chavista revolution would continue. Does this worry the Trump administration? Not that it is showing. Mr. Trump boasted Saturday that Ms. Rodriguez will do what the U.S. wants or else. He threatened a second wave of military intervention if she doesn't. But Mr. Trump didn't say anything about holding new elections as a U.S. goal. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Sunday that elections will need to be held eventually, though he didn't seem to think it's all that urgent. Mr. Rubio seemed confident that the U.S. embargo on Venezuelan oil exports will squeeze the regime enough that it will buckle to U.S. demands. We want drug trafficking to stop. We want no more gang members to come our way. We don't want to see the Iranian and, by the way, Cuban presence in the past. We want the oil industry in that country not to go to the benefit of pirates and adversaries of the United States, but for the benefit of the people, Mr. Rubio said on CBS's Face the Nation. Those are important goals, but Mr. Rubio's implication is that the Maduro apparat can stick around if they heed these demands. This is a risky bet, especially since the regime's new leaders rely so much on aid from Cuba, Russia, China, and Iran. It's unlikely these people will turn into pro-American Democrats. All the more so since the U.S. military left Venezuela at the end of the Maduro operation. Mr. Rubio said Sunday it was unrealistic to take more risks in the raid to decapitate more of the regime, which is fair enough. But despite Mr. Trump's vow that the U.S. will run the country, there is no one on the ground to do so. This may mollify MAGA critics who fear he is imitating George W. Bush's occupation of Iraq. but it reduces the U.S. ability to persuade the regime. Much depends on whether the Maduro crowd fear a second U.S. military strike. Even more depends on whether the Trump administration is willing to push for new elections. The U.S. needn't back any candidate, but a Democratic government of the kind that won the 2024 election only to have it stolen by Mr. Maduro would be a more durable ally. The Trump administration talks about its foreign policy realism, but if Maduro 2.0 remains in defiant power in 6 months, its gamble on his henchmen won't look very realistic. Democratic sanity on rent control. With socialism so much in fashion, the news these days is when a Democratic politician resists its nostrums. A welcome burst of sanity came recently when Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey said she opposes a referendum that would unleash rent control across the state. Speaking on Boston Public Radio, Ms. Healey said she's concerned about housing affordability, but rent control is not going to be the solution to how we get through this crisis. We need to build more homes. She said she'll oppose the ballot measure because the research shows rent control warps the housing market. If you look at the studies, you effectively halt production, Ms. Healey said. I will tell you that investors in housing have already pulled out of Massachusetts because they're concerned about rent control. The ballot measure, which is close to qualifying for the November ballot, would limit rent increases to the Consumer Price Index or 5%, whichever is lower. It would apply to all dwelling units leased for residential, but not commercial use. Massachusetts tried rent control in the 1970s and the 1980s to predictable effect. Landlords pulled units off the market or delayed or limited maintenance. State voters mostly banned the practice in 1994, requiring municipalities to file a home rule petition to impose rent control. But the left wants to overturn that ban and let politicians impose rent controls that would make housing less affordable in the name of making it more affordable. The real answer is to increase housing supply, but that requires reforming zoning laws and making construction rules less costly. Maybe Ms. Healey can give New York's new mayor a tutorial in housing economics. From the opinion pages, Maduro is gone. What's next for Venezuela? Trump says America will run the country for now. A successful transition will require U.S. leadership. By Mary Anastasia O'Grady. The skies over Caracas lit up early Saturday morning as the U.S. struck Venezuelan military installations and key infrastructure in a bid to remove dictator Nicolas Maduro from power. The operation suppressed Venezuelan air defenses, then pulverized military targets, including Fort Tiuna, a key stronghold of regime leadership, La Carlota, military airport, and communication towers. Power was knocked out in parts of the capital. As U.S. Special Forces penetrated the security ring around Mr. Maduro's quarters, sources say many Cuban guards were killed or injured. At 4:21 a.m., President Trump posted that Mr. Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, had been arrested by the U.S. and taken out of the country. A photo circulated of a humiliated Mr. Maduro in a rumpled tracksuit and handcuffs in U.S. custody. Colombian President Gustavo Petro drew a tizzy at the news, as did the communist regime in Havana. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and some congressional Democrats. How dare the U.S. depose a sitting dictator? Mr. Petro's plea for peace was especially rich, given his history as an M19 terrorist. Millions in Venezuelan expat communities around the world erupted in celebration. For the first time in a quarter century of authoritarian chavismo, a return to democracy and pluralism is possible. Venezuelans want to go home. But the job isn't finished. Mr. Trump acknowledged as much on Saturday at a Mar-a-Lago press conference. The U.S., he said, is going to run the country until such time as we can do a safe, proper, and judicious transition. That wasn't expected, and how it will work is now a mystery. Yes, there were U.S. boots on the ground in this operation, but not nearly enough to enforce law and order. Where do we go from here? The ambiguity is unsettling. Nevertheless, it's a good sign that Mr. Trump doesn't think Mr. Maduro's capture is the end of the task at hand. The transition needs U.S. leadership, and the president said he's ready to provide it. Caracas was quiet on Saturday afternoon, and the opposition, which has been preparing for this moment for more than a year under the leadership of Nobel Prize winner Maria Corina Machado, is in wait-and-see mode. The regime has been decapitated, but some Maduro henchmen are digging in. Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello, the most ruthless member of the top echelon, went into hiding, his reputation for cowardice intact. From there, he called Venezuelans to the streets to protest against the U.S. His enforcers were spotted cruising Caracas slums. People mostly stayed inside. Unconfirmed reports say that some military higher-ups fled the country. Mr. Maduro had been given a chance to exit the country without violence, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said at the press conference. Mr. Trump said the Venezuelan had even considered the offer. His decision to decline left the U.S. president little choice but to deliver the shock and awe. Now Mr. Maduro and Ms. Flores will be tried in federal court in the Southern District of New York on drug trafficking charges and face long prison sentences if convicted. Next on the U.S. hit list is Delcy Rodriguez, Mr. Maduro's second in command. She has reportedly been sworn in as the new dictator and is therefore commander-in-chief. Sources say the Trump administration is leaning on her to coordinate a negotiated transition. Venezuelan Democrats understand the importance of the Venezuelan Army, Navy, and Air Force in establishing a peaceful handover of power and new elections. They learned from watching the mistake of de-Batification of Iraq in 2003. Ms. Rodriguez's mission, if she chooses to cooperate with the U.S., is to persuade Defense Minister Vladimir Petrino to step down and order the generals to jump sides. Her future depends on it if Mr. Trump stays true to his word. Ms. Rodriguez is so far calling Mr. Trump's bluff as Mr. Maduro did. She said she's not going anywhere. Pressure from Cuba and Russia and the spoils of the regime's organized crime that keep her in designer handbags are all reasons to hang on. The generals also live the high life and won't want to give it up. Mr. Cabello's die-hard goons are not the surrendering type. Mr. Cabello may be too scared to move, though he's also pledging resistance. The U.S. has shown it can solve these problems. It's rumored to be telling Ms. Rodriguez and Mr. Petrino that they might avoid violence and prison if they get on board toward a peaceful handover of power. But according to Mr. Trump, a second stage of U.S. intervention isn't out of the question. That threat may require action. If the regime is left in place, the January 3rd mission will have been in vain. The Democratic opposition hasn't called its supporters to the streets for fear they might be gunned down by Mr. Cabello's true believers. But it's notable the military hasn't mobilized in the capital. Normally, tanks roll and brigades march when a nation is under attack. Could it be the brass isn't sure the rank and file will engage in the repression the regime depends on? Mr. Trump's candor in telling Colombia's Mr. Petro that he could be next, in a manner of speaking, was refreshing. Mr. Rubio's message to the Cuban regime that its bosses may want to sleep with one eye open also sounded right. But the president's claim that Ms. Machado isn't respected by Venezuelans was gratuitous and uninformed and made him look small. She's widely popular and has unified the country. And while Mr. Trump talked a lot about oil and American cocaine consumption, he never mentioned that some 900 political prisoners are rotting in Venezuelan jails and in danger. They could have used a presidential shout-out and even a warning to those who might harm them. The argument in favor of democracy is built on evidence that Venezuelans want it. They voted for it in the July 2024 presidential election, choosing opposition candidate Armando Gonzalez with nearly 70% of the vote. Mr. Trump has the moral high ground on this one. He could do worse than plant a flag in it. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The scandal of American welfare goes beyond fraud. California spends billions on programs that enrich insiders and don't help the needy, and it's all legal. By Alicia Keys. Economist John Maynard Keynes suggested that the government pay people to dig holes in the ground and then fill them up. This is an apt metaphor for progressive government these days. It creates social dysfunction, then shovels out money to correct it. Dredge, fill, and repeat. Healthcare and social assistance added more than 1.6 million private sector jobs between June 2023 and June 2025, according to comprehensive data from employer payrolls published by the Labor Department in December. Yet the U.S. gained only 1.3 million private jobs during that period, meaning there was a net loss of jobs in other industries. These two industries accounted for more than half of the new establishments, businesses, and nonprofits created over those 2 years. Minnesota's welfare fraud scandal make you wonder. How many of these new entities and their employees are actually helping people? And how many are merely looting the government? More than 90 people have been charged with setting up sham businesses and nonprofits in Minnesota that feasted on Medicaid, food, housing, and other welfare programs. Defendants employed family members and others to provide autism treatment to kids who didn't have autism, to drive the kids to fake appointments, and to feed them while they were there. The fraudulent enterprises didn't provide legitimate public services, though they did employ people in the service of bilking the government. Honest graft may be a bigger scandal than outright fraud. America's all-you-can-eat buffet of health and social benefits, 16 different federal food programs, Medicaid, housing support, child care, and more, provides abundant opportunities for milking the government. Look no further than California, where a vast welfare industrial complex has developed around homelessness, drug addiction, and left-wing identity politics. The Golden State added roughly 188,000 jobs in social assistance between June 2023 and June 2025. Yet only 4,900 private sector jobs in total. During this period, some 153,000 new establishments were created in social assistance. Every vagrant, drug addict, and confused young person needs a social worker and community support. Governor Gavin Newsom's Elevate Youth California initiative claims to address substance use disorder by investing in the leadership development and civic engagement for youth of color and 2S/LGBTQIA+ youth ages 12 to 26 living in communities disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. Grants are funded by taxes on marijuana. Maybe young people wouldn't struggle with substance abuse if the state hadn't legalized marijuana and effectively decriminalized other drugs, or if union-run public schools educated them and molded good character rather than manufacture left-wing culture warriors, or if high minimum wages hadn't killed entry-level jobs for teens. What do these youth-oriented outfits do with the state money they receive? The nonprofit Brotherhood of Elders Network instructs system-impacted Black youth in what it calls the art of being a Black man. Its curriculum explores African culture through rhythm, song, and dance. Another nonprofit, Asian Refugees United, sponsors weekly queer youth art storytellers programming, which combines youth mentorship, leadership development, and creative skill building to reduce substance abuse. The Mixteco Indigena Community Organizing Project fosters community with 60 to 100 indigenous youth from the Mestizo, Zapotec, and many other diasporic communities throughout the Central Coast. The California Youth Empowerment Network sponsored a youth-led bus stop campaign featuring vibrant stigma-free posters that connected youth experiencing housing insecurity to essential resources, including food and shelter. In other words, the state gave money to sign young people up for government benefits. We'll spare readers a long recitation of other examples of Mr. Newsom splashing around money to left-wing groups, which can be found on the state's website. It's possible that work by some grant recipients is reducing recidivism, homelessness, and substance abuse, but it's impossible to know because the state doesn't measure such outcomes. The goal of welfare industrial complex isn't to ameliorate social problems, but to extract more money from the government. Social workers employed by a nonprofit, funded by hospitals and health insurers, spent recent weeks searching for undocumented immigrants to sign up for Medicaid before a deadline that would make them ineligible. A story in The Atlantic this fall described how drug addicts and the mentally ill have been cycling in and out of California hospitals. Every emergency room visit, typically covered by Medicaid, means more money for hospitals. It's no coincidence that hospitals are the loudest opponents of Medicaid reforms. California's Medicaid spending, which pays for Native American exorcisms, music lessons, cooking classes, and many other non-medical services, has ballooned by nearly 50% over the last 2 years. Healthy living starts with a chef in your kitchen, paid by Medi-Cal, one company advertises. A state audit last month flagged it as high risk for fraud, waste, and abuse. You don't say. Say this for union-backed ballot measure that aims to tax the wealth of billionaires to boost spending on Medicaid. It might awaken wealthy liberals to the welfare racket that masquerades as a public service. The Pepper and Salt cartoon shows two pigs standing outside their barn. And the caption? You don't get it. Farm to table and cradle to grave are the same thing. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the January 5th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening.